from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, bombs in Russia, Obamacare begins for 2 million American, pot's legal in Colorado, commercial drone testing in the U.S., and street battles again in Ramadi and Fallujah, Iraq. In Colorado, on New Year's Day, Adam Hartle of Jacksonville, Florida, celebrated outside Denver's 3D pot shop on the first day of sales for legal recreational marijuana in the Rocky Mountain State.
We got some legal weed!
On Sunday and Monday, bombs exploded, terror attacks in the Russian city of Volgograd, just 6 weeks before the Winter Olympic Games begin in Sochi. Here was an eyewitness to one of the attacks in Russia.
All hell broke loose, said this eyewitness. People, flesh, and shards of glass were thrown into the air.
And a huge winter storm, blizzard, they say, roared from Chicago into the Northeast. Here's Linda Husselby at work at a Home Depot in Watertown, Massachusetts.
People come in droves looking for rock salt and ice melt and sand and shovels and ice scrapers and everything. You name it, they want it.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Jill Doherty of CNN, Reed Epstein of Politico, and On Point political news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining us from Washington is Jill Doherty, foreign affairs correspondent for CNN. Jill, welcome back to On Point. Happy 2014.
Hey, thank you very much, Tom. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. And from Washington, Reed Epstein, White House correspondent for Politico. Reed, Happy New Year, and welcome back to you as well.
Happy New Year, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack. Live long and prosper, sir.
Happy New Year to all, Tom, Reed, and Jill.
Let's go straight to Obamacare. The rollout is on, not to sign up, but to actually be covered. Reed Epstein, here we are, just a handful, not even a handful of days in. What can we see at this point about the numbers that have enrolled, about first response to having that, for many, I assume, new coverage at this point?
Well, we can certainly see the White House doing all that it can to celebrate people who have insurance now that didn't have access to it before. We've seen daily calls each. Today's the third day of the year. We saw one yesterday. They had one on the first as well, where people trying to press the story that people are now being covered who didn't have access to healthcare before, painting every healthcare success story that the White House can. And we're going to see more of that as the month goes on. But of course, there are speed bumps along the way. Sonia Sotomayor, who the president, of course, appointed to the Supreme Court late on New Year's Eve, allowed a Catholic nunnery in Denver an exemption in their efforts to keep from having to fulfill the contraception mandate. There's going to be more bumps in the road as this proceeds. The White House hopes that eventually the positive momentum that they see in people being covered and the numbers growing eventually overtakes the negative storyline that has been building since October.
Upping the rhetoric from the White House, downplaying the projection that there should be 7 million signed up. Here on Tuesday was White House advisor Phil Schiller saying he spoke on the last day of the year, the day before coverage began, putting out that positive message from the Obama White House about the Affordable Care Act.
Today is the last day women in the United States can be discriminated against when it comes to insurance simply because they're women. It's the last day a cancer patient could be told by their insurance company that cancer treatments aren't covered. That's just enormous. That's why we're so excited about tomorrow. Enrollment is very important. We're very excited about the increasing numbers. That's only part of the Affordable Care Act story.
Good news, says the White House, but Republicans pointing out glitches aplenty and more remain. Here's Fred Upton, Republican of Michigan, chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, telling Fox News yesterday the bad news of Obamacare may well outweigh the good news.
I mean, let's face it, there are going to be a lot of glitches. Those glitches are going to get quite a bit of attention, and I don't know that the good news for this is going to outweigh the bad news, particularly in the next couple of months, even certainly the next couple of weeks ahead.
Jack Beatty, you're watching this. The 7 million enrolled target was out there. The White House now saying that was never our, i.e. the White House's, target number. What about the sheer sign-up rate here, Jack, and the importance of that for this thing working, for the system to work?
Well, the numbers are not as impressive as the administration wanted, and for the reason we all know, the abysmal rollout. And we don't know the composition, even, of these 2 million people. Is it how many young people and so on? The crucial thing is the young, healthy people to pay for the rest of us. But, you know, if you step back, and put in the 3 million under 26ers who are now on their parents' plan, if you put in the Medicaid expansion people, along with the people on the who've been calling the website to sign up for the exchanges, you're around 9 million people now who have insurance this year who didn't have it last. That's good news for Obamacare. Really bad news, though, also today, an Oregon study, really a double-blind study, a random test of Medicare of Medicaid recipients, finds that, contrary to the claims the president made, and I'm looking at five different statements from the president saying, listen, if we expand Medicaid, emergency room visits will go down. That will translate into savings for everybody. There will be less cost shifting. We'll all save money, $2,000 off a policy. This study says, Medicaid recipients in Oregon went to emergency rooms 40% higher than non-recipients, which just sort of shoots that right out of the water. And as I say, it's a kind of double blind test because it was a random sample. There was a group of people who didn't get the expansion, a group that did. This is really bad news for Obamacare.
Jill Doherty, you've got your eye on a big world, but here we've got two sets of numbers on a very big issue for the United States. Other countries tackle this in their own way. There are enrollment number issues, and there are savings issues. And yes, the premise was give coverage. They'll get care all along the way and won't need those emergency room visits. If that doesn't add up, there could be fiscal issues, presumably, around this new reform, Jill.
Right. I mean, ultimately, it's a question of not only immediately what's going to happen, but what's going to happen down the line. This issue of who's signing up today, in fact, this has been a big issue in the past couple of days. Will they be young? Are they old? Who exactly is signing up? And that's significant because down the line, it will depend on those numbers to see how much this is going to cost. The younger people may not use as much health care, but they will contribute, et cetera, just as insurance works. So I think you're going to have to look at this in terms of what's happening right now, what's happening in 6 months to a year, and then ultimately what happens in the ensuing years. Because if you look at what the White House is saying, they say the ensuing years, eventually people will be getting out of the habit of going to the emergency room, for example. So it's kind of short-term, long-term.
Reid, what's the Republican plan at this point? I mean, we heard in the fall there were waves of attacks planned on the Affordable Care Act. So ensuing years presumes a longevity here. Are the Republicans going to sit around and watch that unfold?
Well, they've taken the tact, you know, since the rollout sort of in earnest became a real problem of essentially letting the administration sort of fall on its own face with the rollout. They've sort of attacked it as sort of the plan won't work. The problem for them now is you have, you know, 2.5 million and growing people who have insurance who didn't before. And in the history of going back to World War II before that, the FDR New Deal programs, it's really hard to take a program away from people once they have it. And so now Republicans heading into the midterms and the 2016 elections are faced with the repeal argument of Obamacare, meaning that there are going to be specific people who Democrats can point to saying, you don't want these people to have health insurance. And without Republicans coming up with their own plan, which to date they haven't done beyond saying that they want to repeal Obamacare, they're in a bit of a pickle because it would be terribly unpopular to repeal something that Americans have. And yet Obamacare itself doesn't pull very well. And they've essentially built a franchise on opposing it.
That is a muddy image. We've got listeners with their own views on 2014. Just begun just a couple of 3 days in here. Tanya in Boston. Thanks for calling, Tanya. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've been hearing that report this morning from Oregon. And, you know, I know that with a lot of this stuff, it's so much easier to comment on all the negative than the positive. And so I get that that's getting all this press. But I wonder, like, we also think that, like, okay, so now we have expanded Medicare, boom, everybody will suddenly start using primary care physicians, when the folks who've been expanded really don't have that because they haven't had that access. They don't have that kind of habit of going to primary care. So it makes sense that they would continue going to the emergency room, and that there has to be some work to get people to kind of build up that habit of going to more primary care physicians. So I don't know if that has been, I mean, it just seems like
no, I hear exactly what you're saying. I mean, we heard the story on NPR, people living on the street, not at all accustomed to health care of any kind. Just because they have access to it doesn't mean that they'll do that kind of meticulous primary care check-ins in advance that might put off something for the ER, or they might go to the ER anyway. Jack, there's a kind of big social change anticipated in this reform, but then it has to actually unfold.
It does, and people have to learn new habits. In this report, which is in Science, I'm reading a report, a precy of it, people, it did increase the use of preventive and primary care. So, yes, they were going to, they were getting preventive care, they were getting primary care, but they were also going to the emergency room. The old habits remain. And Tanya says, well, maybe people will learn new habits, and they will. But already one estimate is that if Obamacare were, you know, universal, all 50 states, this would add at least another $1 billion or more to the cost.
New year begins, and we've got issues at home and abroad. Mike, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, what's top of your list, Mike?
Hi, Tom. I'm on the unemployment food stamp irony with the fiscal easing. I did a quick calculation here. The $85 billion that the Federal Reserve has been handing over to Wall Street in free money, if that money had been on the bottom of the food chain rather than the trickle-down top, there would be 100 million Americans getting roughly $800 to $1,000 a month in money to stimulate the economy. And in my opinion, cutting unemployment and food stamps, which is what John Boehner talks about, and ignoring the fact that Wall Street has been getting $85 billion and sitting on it, collecting free interest, just infuriates me.
It has been pumped in from the top, and of course those long-term unemployment benefits cut with, what, 1.3 million, seeing those benefits expire, many of whom still have no job. Reed Epstein in Washington, there's talk of still turning that around. Is that realistic? Are we likely to bring back that long-term unemployment coverage or not, Reed?
I think you're going to see the White House talk about it when President Obama comes back from Hawaii early next week. It was really, it felt like a missed opportunity for the White House. They were so urgent, so anxious to get the budget deal before Christmas that Senator Patty Murray and House Republican Paul Ryan worked out, that they agreed to it. And there was some discussion about whether they should hold out for the long-term unemployment insurance to be added in. Republicans didn't want to do it. The White House determined that it was better to take that long-term budget deal and eliminate risk of another government shutdown in the new year than to wait for a deal to be worked out on unemployment insurance. And as a result, like you said, 1.3 million people lost their unemployment insurance. It's Democrats, particularly in the House, think it's a good issue for them to fight on, but there's not really a path for them to get it through since there's no way to force House Republicans to take it now that the budget deal has passed.
We've got more at home, but some arresting events abroad in this week. In Volgograd, this is north, kind of northeast of Sochi, where the Winter Olympics are coming up in just, what, 6 weeks now. A couple of bombings, terror bombings that got the whole world's attention and certainly Russia's attention on the eve of the Sochi Olympics. Here's Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday. He met with victims of the bombings, talked to the media, here interpreted by CNN.
The abomination of this crime, or crimes, that were committed here in Volgograd does not need any additional commentary. No matter what motivated the criminals' actions, there is no justification for committing crimes against civilians, especially against women and children.
Unclear what's going on there exactly, but it is clear that a lot of athletes from around the world will be heading into Russia. And soon, Tuesday, in an interview with NBC's Today Show, Scott Blackman, CEO of the U.S. Olympic Committee, said he's concerned about the recent bombings, but has confidence, he said, in security measures for the Games.
The reality is that there are different challenges at every Games. In this case, we got, you know, a preview of what could happen, but we're very hopeful that the Russians' commitment to security, which is, you know, frankly, one of the highest levels of commitment we've ever seen from a government and an organizing committee, will serve us well.
Jill Doherty, you're just back from Russia. We'll get to the Winter Olympics in Sochi, but who's bombing and why here? Is it clear? Do we know?
You know, nobody so far has taken responsibility for the bombings, but you would have to say the man that everybody would look to would be Doku Umarov. He's a terrorist leader a Chechen. But, you know, remember, Chechnya has pretty much been pacified, and most of the people have now moved into Dagestan. And remember, Dagestan was the place that the Boston bombers, you know, people who were allegedly involved in that, lived, and also one visited there. So it's really the hotbed of terrorism. And Umarov, over the years, has given threats, many, that he was going to destroy Putin, destroy Russia. He wants to create an emirate, an Islamic emirate. So recently, in July, he said to his followers, do what you can to disrupt these Olympics. And so, obviously, the finger points at him. He hasn't said anything, but it's very worrisome because this is a very big deal for Vladimir Putin. $50 billion on these Olympics, the most expensive Winter Olympics in history. And it's in the spotlight. If something happens at the Olympics, it's going to be a very big bad advertisement for Vladimir Putin.
We think of Russia's security apparatus as big, heavy, and strong, but we've also seen Chechen attacks all over the place, even into the heart of Russia, for many years here. What about the security, the simple security of these games?
You know, I think you'd have to say, when you talk to experts, what they're saying is the site itself, where the Olympics will be taking place in Sochi, will probably be, let's call it, sanitized. They're going to have more security forces than you can ever imagine down there. They've been going door to door looking for bad guys. And unless something very unexpected happens, and that's entirely possible, but for the most part, that could be secure. But right outside of that perimeter, you're in an area that, in essence, has been a war zone. Just to the east of that, all of these areas in the Caucasus. And don't forget, you know, Sochi is as close to the Middle East, really closer to the Middle East than it is to Moscow. So it's a very different area. And that is the danger, that even if they can shut down the Olympics and make them secure, the terrorists have a very good incentive to create havoc in other parts of Russia.
Interesting that part of Russia's interest in the status quo, or Assad in Syria, I've read, is that they're afraid that change there could flow over and lead to Islamist activity within their borders. Olympics coming, the whole world watching now. Kristen in Des Moines, Iowa. Kristen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
All right, so I've got an interesting one here for you. It steps a little bit away from the United States.
Fine.
It seems like unrest throughout the world is becoming an everyday talking point. In spite of political and diplomatic efforts to provide relief and work towards stability, refugees flood from places like Syria and now South Sudan to neighboring nations, putting a significant strain on the region as a whole. I'm personally worried that regional unrest will continue to spread, placing strains on countries that previously might have thought themselves immune to the effects of unrest in neighboring regions.
What's to be done about it, Kristen, when you have it in so many places and without a single one single theme of motivation or reason?
That's a difficult question, honestly. I'm not sure that I know the answer. I'm a mere college student taking some philosophy courses that make me start thinking about this stuff. But really, I mean, globalization, everyone needs to help. Nobody is in this alone anymore.
It's right to be on your radar. Sharp examples this week, a conflict in southern Sudan, certainly, and yes, in Syria and across the border in Iraq, Fallujah and Ramadi. Both of those, at least for a while, I think this fighting's still going on, but Iraqi central security forces out of Baghdad losing control there, al-Qaeda-linked militants under the same banner as jihadists in Syria, taking over key points in those cities where so many American lives were lost. Militants have been chanting, God is great, making their way through the streets. Here's the BBC's Tim Allman reporting.
It's the first time since the withdrawal of U.S. forces that the Iraqi government has lost control of two major cities. This latest unrest was sparked by a security operation on Monday when soldiers dismantled a protest camp in Ramadi, Sunni Muslims voicing opposition to the Shia-led government.
Jill Doherty, Fallujah, Ramadi, Anbar province, these are storied, bloody names in American military history in Iraq. And people are talking about spillover, but there's tension in Iraq, too, and lots of violence. What do you see going on in the, at least temporary, and we'll see, almost loss of these two cities to the Baghdad central government and the prominence of al-Qaeda militants in the center of the takeover?
You know, I think you're going to have to look at this in a regional sense, because obviously Iraq has this situation going on. But the previous caller made a very good point that right now you have Al-Qaeda metastasizing. It already has for years, but now it really is noticeable in so many of these areas, in Sudan, in Libya, etc. Groups that are not the core Al-Qaeda, but they are affiliated, they're breakaways, they are often motivated by some kind of general idea. I could mention Russia, for instance, this idea of Islamic anger, sometimes building an Islamic emirate or some type of Islamic union throughout the world. But they are many of these groups are really carrying out their own mission and claiming that they are tied to Al-Qaeda. It gets very confusing, but it's very chaotic. And how to fight in each individual group is complex. They each have their own local grievances.
We're going to look into the new ferocity of the violence in Iraq. There's been a lot going on. And Fallujah Ramadi on Monday right here, big report in the New York Times, a week ago now, nearly, on what happened in Benghazi. They went back and step by step, hour by hour, nearly minute by minute, put it together. Some supporting what the administration had said, some not. Republicans still saying, look, this was about Al-Qaeda. The administration tried to cover that up. Here was the Times reporter David Kirkpatrick. This was on Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press, saying that September 11th, 2012 attack that killed Ambassador Chris Stevens in Benghazi was not perpetrated by Al-Qaeda and was in part, as the administration had said, a reaction to the infamous anti-Muslim video that was around.
I think, honestly, if you asked anybody in the U.S. intelligence business, they would tell you the same thing. There's just no chance that this was an Al-Qaeda attack if, by Al-Qaeda, you mean the organization founded by Osama bin Laden.
Republican Congressman Daryl Issa wasn't having it on the same show, saying, look, you've got Al-Qaeda connections here.
There is a group that was involved, that claims an affiliation with Al-Qaeda. Now, Al-Qaeda is not a central command and control. It was, in fact, a loose group that could take general statements and act on them. The important thing in our investigation, in the Oversight Committee investigation, where people have said under oath repeatedly they were not given the security they asked for in advance.
Huge report on Benghazi after such a long time of controversy. Reed Epstein, is the White House taking this as a validation of their depiction of events there? And how sound is that validation?
You know, we haven't seen a whole lot of reaction from the White House about the Times story in itself. What we've seen more is the Republicans, like the clip you played of Daryl Issa, talking about it being a whitewash. Of course, it's no surprise to see Republicans if they can take a shot at the New York Times and the White House in the same breath, they're not going to pass that up on too many occasions. But what we're seeing is that a lot of the conspiracy theories about Benghazi haven't held up to close scrutiny. That's sort of this case. The Times may not be the perfect messenger of this sort of story. And to be honest, I'm not sure that it helps the White House, and it certainly doesn't help Hillary Clinton to have this sort of in the bloodstream and have it be a topic of discussion. The White House would certainly much rather be talking about sort of the healthcare successes or the places where its foreign policy has done well overseas, and not necessarily about Benghazi.
We've got news from Russia to the Middle East to Colorado, where pot is legal this week. Dan in Nashville, Tennessee. Dan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I'm an addiction physician in Nashville, and I'd have to say my comment straddles really a couple of your topics. My observation is that the legislators in Colorado have taken a debate that's been characterized by hyperbole and tried to cut through the smoke, no pun intended.
Yep.
They're making some practical adjustments to the law. And what's it appears to me that they're trying to apply some common sense to what's been a very difficult debate that's lasted for 20 years.
So you're an addiction physician. Are you saying with that, Dan, that you support the legalization of recreational marijuana?
I don't think that any ethical physician could endorse the inhalation of burning weeds, whether you're talking about pot or tobacco or tree bark. But I do think that decriminalizing this relatively harmless substance is a better idea than dividing our culture. And I think what's really hopeful about this is that we have many debates in our culture right now that are characterized by hyperbole, and these folks have worked out a very difficult compromise. So, you know, I see it as sort of the beginning of an opportunity to work out compromise over many issues.
Dan, I really appreciate your perspective. People still, I mean, everybody's watching this to see where this goes. Washington State already some ways down this road. There was a press conference at a marijuana dispensary in Denver on Wednesday. Betty Alworth, advocacy director for the Campaign to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol legalization effort, said that this legalization is good for the community and the economy.
Marijuana does not have to be a burden on our communities. It doesn't have to be a burden on our criminal justice systems, and it does not have to be a burden on our economies. In fact, the sale of legal marijuana can be a boon.
Tax revenue, Jack. Tax revenue. What could be wrong?
What could be wrong, indeed? You know, David Brooks this morning has a sentence that really got my attention. We now have a couple of states, Colorado and Washington, that have gone into the business of effectively encouraging drug use. You're taken aback when you see that. Yes, decriminalization sounds like a grand idea and so on, but do we really want usage to be sort of something the state has an interest in promoting?
I mean, we've had legal alcohol for a long, long time, Jack. The Budweiser Clydesdale has run all over the place.
That's true. And there have been a lot of unintended consequences of that, and I expect of this too. But, you know, there are about six other states that are watching this very closely. And if there isn't too much of a backlash, we don't get, you know, mass murder on Tweed, which we're not likely to, we're probably going to see this happen in a lot of other places.
Reed Epstein, last week it was Uruguay making marijuana legal. Now we've got it in Colorado, Washington coming, half a dozen more states looking at this. Is this another one of these trends that looks like it has legs, that it's likely, like gay marriage, to move across the country, Reed?
I don't know if it has the sort of institutional support of gay marriage. Part of it will be, you know, other states will be watching to see what happens in Colorado and Washington State. In Colorado, if you've been in Denver in the last year or so, you've seen these dispensaries popping up, to use a bad pun, like a weed,
And they're big affairs. These are not little shops. It's almost supermarket stuff.
Some of them are. I mean, most of them are like the size of a fast food restaurant, mm-hmm. where you see cars. You know, I was in Colorado in July, and you would see people sitting in their cars in 90-degree weather in Colorado, where it's beautiful outside. They'd be sitting crouched in their car, smoking a joint in the parking lot of the dispensary.
Okay.
Which seemed not to make a whole lot of sense, but, you know, at the time, it was still the stigma about smoking in public. And if it works in Colorado, in Washington, you'll see other states pick it up.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a Chinese helicopter rescue scooped up all 52 passengers from a beleaguered Russian research ship that had been stuck in Antarctic ice since Christmas Eve. They were glad to get off.
The first of the helicopters to take us home! Thanks, everyone!
Controversy in California around 13-year-old Jahai McMath, who was pronounced brain dead. Her family wants to keep her alive using life support. Her doctors say there's no hope she will recover. Sam Singer, a spokesman for Children's Hospital Oakland, said the family is being misled.
The family attorney has created a hoax, a very sad hoax, that Jahai McMath is in some way alive.
And happy 2014 with fire in the sky. Fireworks on New Year's Eve in Dubai set a world record for largest ever pyrotechnics display. Over 500,000 fireworks were used. Big boom. For a video of those fireworks in Dubai, check out our website, onpointradio.org. It's pretty amazing. We're looking at a week in the news, and you can join us. I want to look at the newly inaugurated mayor of New York. But first, if I may, read news from the FAA this week that they are laying out test sites for commercial drone aircraft in the United States. We saw Jeff Bezos on 60 Minutes talking about one day Amazon may have little flying doodads, delivering your books or whatever it is to your very doorstep. But here they've got sites all over the United States where they're looking to work out safety standards and how to certify ground-based pilots and try and ensure the aircraft will be safe and don't run into each other. New day dawning here in our American skies, Reed.
Well, it's certainly the chances of this Jeff Bezos Amazon dream of delivering a book or,
burritos,
a packet of toilet paper to your house in a half hour or less is a little bit closer to happening. There's many companies that are looking to get into this commercial drone market. We see it in Politico all the time. You see stories about, from our transportation reporters about the different types of companies angling for government business. Certainly, the expectation is that in a number of years we'll be using commercial drones. Will be sort of part of American life in the same way that the internet or cell phones are. That it'll be yet another tool used to get products from one place to another quickly.
Little helicopters and drones of all kind flying all over half a dozen different institutions designated to go out and test them and figure out how to deal with America's new skies. Lots of thoughts on the very New Year's news online today. Jill, Reed, Jack. Angie says inequality. This is the issue. And it was a big issue in the inaugural address of the new mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, who said here his goals go beyond keeping the city clean, safe, up, and running.
We are called to put an end to economic and social inequalities that threaten to unravel the city we love.
And he had more to say on that theme. Here he is, Bill de Blasio, the mayor.
I know that there are those who think that what I said during the campaign was just rhetoric. And there are some who think that now, as we turn to governing, well, that things will just continue pretty much the way they always have. So let me be clear. When I said I would take dead aim at the tail of two cities, I meant it.
Jack Beatty, he's one mayor in one city, but it's a big city, and the New York mayor typically has national prominence. And this is a kind of a new front and center message.
It is indeed, and the symbolism used a Bible FDR had used, and he was sworn in by Bill Clinton with Hillary Clinton right there, and I think that symbolism does nationalize it. Hillary Clinton now, any Democrat now, will have to speak foremost to the issue of inequality. The page of politics has turned. You know, there was a political scientist named E.E. Schatzschneider, forgive me, mm-hmm. who wrote a wonderful book about politics, and he had a sentence in there that applies. He said, the supreme act of politics is the definition of alternatives. He who gets to say what politics is about rules. Well, think of in our experience, Ronald Reagan in 1981 inaugural, government is the problem. That was the definition of alternatives. The Democrats had to come back and say, oh, it's not really the problem. And for 30 years, or well, at least certainly 20 years, the Reagan paradigm ruled. Now the Democrats have a new paradigm. Inequality is a big problem, morally, socially, economically. We've got to do something about it. The Republicans are going to have to respond.
We've got midterm elections this year, Reed. How do you see those lining out thematically? Is it inequality versus government and deficit? What do you see coming, Reed?
Well, we're certainly going to see the White House and Democrats on Capitol Hill pushing if not as blatant as Bill de Blasio in New York, but they're going to be pushing for a higher minimum wage. They're going to be pushing for more help for the poor and the middle class than we've seen in the first 5 years of this presidency. Of course, the minimum wage hike has about as much chance as people sunbathing in Washington today when it's 20 degrees, because the House Republicans are just not going to go for it. But Democrats think it's a political winner for them. It's something that tends to come up every couple of years in an election year when there's not a whole lot else that can be accomplished with divided government. So what we're going to see the White House and Democrats do is push things that they think are political winners for them heading into the midterms. They think that the minimum wage hike is something that can help them in November in the polls and put Republicans on the defensive.
Jill, I don't know if you're watching this issue, but John Boehner talking this week about immigration and maybe a new approach to doing something there. Do you see that coming back onto the docket in Washington this year in a serious way? The president said in his inaugural just a year ago it would be big, and it was not.
It wasn't. And for a while there, just recently, it looked as if it was really kind of the end. Interesting that Boehner is talking about that. Obviously, the Republicans have been under some criticism for not moving ahead, I guess because they can't quite get their act together on how they want to approach it. They know it's a big issue, but how to solve it is one of the problems. So it is, you're right, not exactly my bailiwick, but I'm watching from the sidelines.
Let's go with the Secretary of State for a moment here. He's in Israel right now, 10th visit there, working on a potential peace deal between the Israelis and Palestinians. Here's John Kerry at a press conference yesterday with Prime Minister Netanyahu, saying the peace between Israel and the Palestinians is not mission impossible.
We have been at this now for 5 months solid into 6 months. I think it's safe to say that we know what the issues are. And as I said not so many months ago, you know, the time is soon arriving where leaders are going to have to make difficult decisions. We are close to that time, if not at it.
Doesn't exactly sound like a bandwagon there, and Netanyahu didn't exactly sound ready to roll. He said the Palestinians are still the problem.
I know that you're committed to peace. I know that I'm committed to peace. But unfortunately, given the actions and words of Palestinian leaders, there's growing doubt in Israel that the Palestinians are committed to peace.
Jill Doherty, in a week when we are reading that former Prime Minister, big figure Ariel Sharon, has been close to death, here's John Kerry on his 10th visit. He's invested a lot here. Does it look any closer to some kind of breakthrough or new path? Why is he investing so much right now with everything going on in the world in this issue?
It's really his mission. I mean, he's decided that this is the thing he wants to try to solve. And don't forget that, you know, John Kerry is a former senator, and he does have that idea that he can walk into a room, shake somebody's hand, do a lot of work. I mean, there's no question he's really been very, very, moving very quickly and going back constantly to try to bring this together. But he really feels that he can do a deal based on his own personality, plus the information and negotiation that he needs. So whether he can do this, I think you have to look at what he's talking about. It's really a framework. This is not a final deal, but it would be significant if he could bring those two sides together. And what they're talking about, Tom, is really, a guideline for the permanent status negotiations that would get into all of those issues, you know, the borders, Jerusalem, security, refugees, et cetera. But it's not just getting this, let's say, roadmap or this guideline. It's also getting the buy-in from both sides, and it's getting a buy-in from President Obama, because you have to take a leap of faith. And is President Obama willing to do that? It's a very sensitive issue. Obviously, as soon as you say the word Israel, domestically it becomes an issue. So is President Obama also willing to commit to this when it comes right down to it?
Jack Beatty, no disrespect, but after all these years and with the scale of these issues, a deal here based on John Kerry's personality?
that would seem a remote.
I mean, he's working hard. We see that. That's a lot of visits. But why this one, do you think, Jack, for him?
I can't fathom it. I think he deserves points for taking it on. And I've heard language. He said, we've been working on this for the last 5 months, we've been working on it for the last generation, and inertia has a kind of momentum. I mean, it's sort of nothing happening seems to lead to the assumption that nothing will happen. I just noticed this week the Times had a piece on a new sticking point, which is that the Netanyahu government wants the Palestinians to recognize Israel, not just recognize Israel, but recognize it, quote, as a Jewish state.
Yeah.
Well, the Palestinians say no. That throws our whole narrative about our peoplehood out the window. We can't go there. So even at this late hour, all these years later, a new issue injected. Kerry says it's not mission impossible. It's certainly mission improbable.
One wonders if other events in the region will reframe even this and potentially soon Reed Epstein, I want to turn to Edward Snowden, of course, with all of his revelations on the NSA's activity last year, newspapers cooperating with him, The Guardian, The New York Times, to bring some of those stories to public. And in this last week, The Times calling for clemency for Snowden. Do you see a chance of that in Washington, Reed?
No. President Obama, at least in the short term, is not going to offer clemency to Edward Snowden, particularly after Snowden has essentially embarrassed the White House and the United States security apparatus on an international scale and continues to do so. The Times editorial was interesting. It said that Snowden outed people who deliberately broke the law, as one of my colleagues pointed out last night. The NSA had more than a dozen court judgments from judges who approved these surveillance methods that declared that they were legal. And so the argument for pardoning or offering Snowden some sort of clemency or leniency rides on the fact that he exposed something that was illegal when, at least from the perspective of the NSA and the government, all the legal mechanisms to approve these things had said that they were legal.
And I didn't get you on immigration, Reed. Does the White House, does the Obama administration look forward to something actually happening there this year, or are they thinking stalemate and campaign on it?
Well, the way that you can tell that the White House thinks that immigration is going to pass is if they're not talking about it. So when you see the president out calling for Republicans to vote on immigration, calling for the Senate bill to be passed. When he's doing that, it means that they don't think it's going to pass. Immigration has had the best chances of getting through Congress when President Obama has stayed publicly away from it, allowed some more backroom negotiations to take place. That's how it got through the Senate. That was how they made some progress and momentum in the House. But until John Boehner and sort of the House Republican majority can get around to backing something like this, it's just not going to go anywhere. And if it's seen as an Obama initiative, they're not going to back it.
Jill, let us take it abroad to a really wild story. We all heard about Kim Jong-un, the young leader of North Korea, having executed his uncle not long ago. Story out of Wen Weibo newspaper, kind of mainland China-related in Hong Kong, saying that the path to that death was his uncle was stripped naked, thrown into a cage, and eaten alive by a pack of ravenous dogs, along with five of his closest aides, 120 hunting hounds, which had been starved for 5 days. Completely eaten up is the phrase used here. Is this some kind of propaganda? Can you see what sort of story is this?
Well, anything is possible in North Korea. Having been there, I can tell you directly. Yes, it is. But what's happening there, every day it's back and forth. You know, remember in the beginning, the young leader was trying to make overtures. Then he became an ogre, perhaps worse than his father. Where they are moving right now, the problem is they are very unpredictable, and being unpredictable gets some points because you never know what they're going to do. It could strike terror into the hearts of people. And that helps them. But I think the Chinese are getting very tired of this. Certainly the U.S. has been working with the Chinese to kind of, you know, put some pressure on the North Koreans. But the North Koreans are very adept at very corrupt deals with other countries. And they're not as crazy as they look.
A Communist Party mouthpiece newspaper, this has often been seen. One really wonders what's going on here. And they say Kim Jong-un himself and his brother supervised hour-long ordeal with 300 other officials. Talk about spectator sport. But you wonder if this could be Beijing, you know, painting them in the worst light, making distance here, Jill.
It could. I mean, again, they are getting pretty tired of this. They would like to deal with North Korea, and North Korea would like to deal with China. But the unpredictability of them is beginning to wear on the Chinese. The Chinese like nothing more than predictability. And they always worry about if the regime collapses, that a lot of people are going to be coming over the border into China, which will be highly destabilizing. So for years, the Chinese have tried to keep it together. But the new leader is really, maybe he's not new anymore, but the young leader is really making that very difficult.
Reed, just a half minute here. Utah is looking to the Supreme Court for a stay on to block the same-sex marriage ruling that's opened up same-sex marriage there. Any early sign whether the Supreme Court may go on that, Sonia Sotomayor or more?
You know, we haven't seen any tea leaves from the Supreme Court. Certainly, Utah is not the only state where courts have legalized gay marriage. It's not the last state where courts will legalize gay marriage. And what we're looking towards is another sort of epic Supreme Court battle, like the one we saw last summer, perhaps the one that would build a precedent for all 50 states.
And we are into a new year. 2014 here, blizzard in the Northeast. Thanks a lot, Chicago. And off we go. Thanks to all of you for being with us this hour. Jill Doherty, foreign affairs correspondent for CNN. I think you'll be up in our neck of the woods soon, Jill. We look forward to seeing you.
Yeah, I will.
Good, great. Reed Epstein, White House correspondent for Politico. Thanks for joining us today, Reed.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack, Happy New Year, sir. May it be a good one for all.
Thank you. I return that.
Happy New Year, listeners. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.